I want to invite you to turn to Luke chapter 7. Pastor Anita's going to come read it to us from verse 36 through 47 this morning.
Then one of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him, and he went to the Pharisee's house and sat down to eat. And behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil and stood at his feet behind him weeping. And she began to wash his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. And she kissed his feet and anointed them with the fragrant oil. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he spoke to himself, saying, "This man, if he were a prophet, would know who and what manner of a woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner." And Jesus answered and said to him, "Simon, I have something to say to you." So he said, "Teacher, say it." There was a certain creditor who had two debtors. One owed 5,000 denarii and the other 50. And when they had nothing with which to repay, he freely forgave them both. "Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him more?" Simon answered and said, "I suppose the one whom he forgave more." And he said to him, "You have rightly judged." Then he turned to the woman and said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I entered your house and you gave me no water for my feet, but she has washed my feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. You gave me no kiss, but this woman has not ceased to kiss my feet since the time I came in. You did not anoint my head with oil, but this woman has anointed my feet with fragrant oil. Therefore I say to you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little." Amen.
Delighted that you're here today. And some of you are wearing orange, some of you are wearing, it looks like peach to me, and I realize there are so many Georgia fans here, but you could take that up with your washer, I suppose. There was a young preacher who was interviewing for his first church. He sat down with the pastoral search committee, and they asked him pretty routine questions. They ask him about his doctrine and about his Christian experience. They ask him what he would do if he was their pastor. And then they close the question and answer session. The chairman asked the board, he said, "Now, do any of you want to ask this preacher any more questions before we move on?" The elder member of that board said, I have two questions for him." He said, "Young man, these are the two questions. Do you love people? And I assume that you do. So if you do love people, how do you know you love people?" If you think about those two questions, I think the first one's easy. I think if you were to ask each one here that question, "Do you love people?" the answer is, "Yes, I love people." But then if you go to the second question and ask, "Well, how do you know you love people?" if you think about it, that gets a little dicey. I mean, our culture is saturated with love. The pornographer puts the word love in his movie to sell it. The TV preacher looks right into the camera, and right before he asks you for your generous donation, he says, "Now I love you." Even in the newspaper, sometimes you read about murder being done in the name of love. I mean, it was a crime of passion, the editor writes. To put your finger on what it really means to be a loving person, if you think about it, isn't such an easy question to answer. If you push it a little farther, since we're in church together, how do you know you love people? How do you know you love Jesus? I mean, throughout the scriptures, we're told that loving Jesus is fundamental. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 22 that this is the great commandment. He says to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, and mind. Later on, he'll say to Peter, who made a mess of his life, who made a mess of Christian service, there was many things to talk to Peter about after he had fallen. But Jesus came to him, and three times he asked him, Peter, do you love me? Do you love me, Peter? Do you love me? And it is as though Jesus is getting past all the lesser important questions of Peter, why did you do it? Peter, why couldn't you have stood strong? Peter, why did your faith fail? It seems as though Jesus is moving past all of those questions and saying, let's just get to the important question at hand, Peter. Do you love me? It's not an unimportant question. How do you know you love Jesus? And to answer that question, I'd like to use Luke chapter 7 as a text this morning, because as far as I can tell, this is the only place where Jesus actually says in his encounters with people, you see this person loves me. This is what love looks like. This is what much love looks like. Jesus is saying, this is what your love should look like. And so he holds up this woman who comes to anoint his feet. And one of the things we find very quickly here is that loving a person means, loving Jesus means, that you move beyond asking, what do I need to do? And you start asking the question, what would he want me to do? Now notice this woman. She comes, and this text says she was a prostitute. There's a passage in John chapter 12 that's a parallel passage to this one. And we're told that her name is Mary, of the Mary and Martha grouping. This is Mary, according to John 12. She too came and anointed his feet with a fine fragrance. And it's unlikely that two women did this in the life of the ministry of Jesus. So these two are lumped together, the John chapter 12 Mary, who also comes to anoint his feet here, and then the prostitute. And it says that she comes, and she fights her way into this room, no doubt. She is not welcome in this room of Pharisees. She fights her way to the place of Jesus. She kneels, and she anoints his feet with a vial of perfume. It's an alabaster box. Now, why did she need that alabaster box? Well, it's pretty obvious. She's a prostitute. And in that day and age, every street smelled worse than a cattle barn. I mean, there were live animals. Did they have horses? I guess they had horses. I don't know. How old's horses? Horses and cattle and goats and sheep and animals running loose, and you can imagine what the streets smell like. And there were human remains on the street, and it was just a vile place to live. Everything stunk. And so for her job, she had to have this bottle of perfume. It was made in such a way that the perfume could not spill out. There was maybe a pinhead opening at the top. The perfume could not get out, but the fragrance could get out, and it would create a cloud of aroma around her. And that's what she needed to do her job in that place. Now, John says that it was worth 300 denarii. And virtually all the commentators say that that was equivalent to a year's wages in that culture. And so here is a woman. She pushes her way into this room, and she's not comfortable there. At least she's not made welcome there. And she takes the most valuable thing that she owns, this bottle of perfume, absolutely critical to her occupation. And in fact, we know that she's repenting, because once she breaks this, she cannot afford to replace it. She's basically giving up the life that she led, because this was crucial to that life, and she won't be able to replace it. It's worth a year's wages to her, and she breaks it, and she uses it to anoint the feet of Jesus. I wonder how much you make. $10,000 a year, $20,000 a year, 40, 60, more? I mean, think about that vast amount of money being poured out in one instant on Jesus' feet. This is not a woman who's asking, you know, what, how much do I need to do? I mean, what's the baseline that I need to reach to get in favor with Jesus? She's not asking, what do I need to do? She's asking, what would Jesus want me to do? What would impress Jesus? And that's crucial if you claim to love him. I remember when I was a teenager and teenage boys, some friends and I would get together and we would talk about sports, but then we would have another subject of conversation, which was girls. And it seemed like our conversations frequently discussed the subject, how cheaply can you get out of a date form? We talk about that. You girls don't understand how guys think. This is the way they think. And so 20 years ago, we would sit around and we would discuss how cheaply could you get out of a date for. And at that point, you could go to the movies for a dollar and a half. There was a dollar and a half theater in town. And we would devise ways of not spending money on girls. Not that we had any dates, but we had a plan if we had a date. And but one of the plans, for instance, was, you know, you could ask her to the movie. And if you ask her to the 7 o'clock movie, she's going to want to go out to eat at 5. And so you're stuck with the price of a meal. And in those days, McDonald's didn't have the dollar menu and you could be out of fortune. So you want to avoid the meal. And so you needed to ask her to the 9:30 movie. Then you'd be out of the food issue. And then she's there in front of the movie. The key is to be late to the movie. And if you're late, see, and if you're running late, you can call and you can say, you know, I'm running late and some things have come up and I'm going to be there. I want to be with you. I've looked forward to this evening. But I would feel safer since it's 9:30 for you to wait on the inside because there's a lot of crazy characters hanging out. You need to wait on the inside for me because I care about your safety. And if she wasn't smart enough to figure out we just beat her out of the price for a movie, but thought that was a romantic gesture that we cared about her, we beat her out of a buck and a half. And we would have a plan for how to handle the refreshment issue. You always, you know, Junior Mints, if you bring in Junior Mints in your pocket, that's a no-brainer. Who can refuse Junior Mints? And we, you know who thinks like that? Boys who aren't in love. That's who thinks. Because all of those boys, when they fell in love, they quit thinking about how to beat her out of the price of a movie. I mean, when you fall in love, you quit thinking about how you're going to convince her that a solitary rose is actually far more romantic than a dozen. You buy the dozen and you take them to her. You quit trying to beat her out of it. Why? Because you love her. And you quit asking, how cheaply can I get out of a date for her? And you quit, and you start asking, you know, what would make her happy? What would please her? What would she want me to do? I mean, look at me. I'm married and I'm already out of the price of a house. It's gone far beyond movies. But that's what love does for you. That's what you do when you love. I'm not saying it's a wrong question to ask. But if you find yourself asking frequently, you know, how many times do you really have to go to church? How much money do you really have to give? How much do you really have to do? I'm not saying those are wrong questions to ask. I'm sure that those are theological questions that cross your mind and you keep asking them. But I just want to point out something to you. When you love somebody, you quit asking, what's the minimum I can get away with? It's just a principle. And I'm not saying those are stupid questions, but I am saying that if you dwell upon those questions, how cheaply can I serve Jesus Christ for? It does say something about your heart that isn't flattering. It does say that there's love lacking in there because if your heart was overflowing, you probably wouldn't be asking those questions with the frequency that you do. Notice that this woman, she's not asking, how cheaply can I get away with? How cheaply can I honor God with? She's pouring it out on him. That's the first thing she's doing. But secondly, and akin to this, when you love somebody and you see this in her, what was frequently unreasonable becomes reasonable. Now notice, what she is doing is unreasonable to all the other people. It's unreasonable to the host. In John chapter 12, the parallel passage, Judas plays into that passage. He's a major player, and he's aghast at what she did. He said, do you know how many poor people we could have fed for that? That is entirely unreasonable. How could you let her do that, Jesus? It's unreasonable to him. It doesn't make any sense to him, but she loves him, and so it makes perfect sense to her that she should spend a vast amount bringing him honor and glory. I wonder how you feel when you hear missionaries talk deep down in your heart. How do you really feel about the sacrifices many make? This Tuesday, my wife and I entertained a couple that are missionaries in Asia, and I could tell you where, but this sermon gets broadcast, and if the people in their town knew that they were missionaries, they might be dead. It's a very dangerous spot of the world for them. And we met the wife many years ago when she was still single. And interesting story, she came to her parents and she wanted to be a missionary 8,000 miles away from home. And they said, you got to get married. And she said, I don't need a man, I have God. And they said, no, you got to stay here. You can't go to a place you've never been, where they speak a language you don't know how to speak, without a man in your life. And she said, I have God, and God has called me to go, and that's enough for me. Now, she went, she met another missionary while she was there. They're raising a wonderful family. But how do you feel when you hear people say stuff like that? I mean, do you say, no, that's a little unreasonable. I mean, why can't you serve God here? Why can't you make money here and send money over there if you can support them financially? I mean, we have comfortable pews here. Her existence over there, her whole kitchen is a hot plate in a apartment that's really the size of a hotel room. And that's where they're raising their children. Do you look at that and say, that's pretty unreasonable? Well, maybe it is, but to her, it isn't unreasonable. It's not unreasonable to her because she fell in love with Jesus at a point in her life. And so serving him in a grand way, giving her life to him, isn't a small unreasonable thing to her. It's just what she does. I mean, listen, 2 weeks ago I preached and we looked at Romans chapter 12. And I've preached on that passage before. And I think I know how people think when you read, you are to present your body as a living sacrifice, which is your reasonable service. I know how people, I think, listen to that sermon. I mean, when the preacher says, you are to present your body. And body doesn't mean less than body. It's got to be your body. You know how people think. It's like, uh-oh, I hope he doesn't get unreasonable. I mean, I hope he doesn't talk about what I put in my body. That would be unreasonable. I hope he doesn't mention death by Big Mac. You know, I hope he doesn't get into my food consumption, because that would be unreasonable. We're only talking about eternal destiny here. We're not talking about our food intake. I mean, I know how people think. They say, oh, I hope body doesn't mean actually what you put on your body. I mean, when we present our bodies as a living sacrifice, that would have absolutely nothing to do with the itsy bitsy teeny weeny polka dot thingy that I wear at the beach to swim in. I mean, certainly presenting your body means absolutely nothing to how you dress your body, because that would be just unreasonable. It doesn't mean what I listen to, does it? I mean, presenting your body, that's not going to affect the kind of music I listen to on the way to work, is it? I mean, that doesn't include my ears, right? The body minus the ears, that's what he means, right? I mean, that's the way we think. We think of the call to dedicated living sacrifice service, and we say, ooh, a living sacrifice. Well, as long as that doesn't include my time or resources, I can do it. What else have you got but your time and resources to give? If you don't give your time and resources, what else have you got? But we read that and we say, wow, that's getting very unreasonable for me. But maybe it's because you don't love like other people love. Because when you start to love, all those silly things you thought were unreasonable, they start to become reasonable. All the money you thought was stupid to spend, you start to spend it on your loved ones. I mean, I know what it's like before I had kids. I used to pity those people sitting in the gym parking lot Saturday. Look at them. Miserable lot. They're going to sit there all day and watch their kids play sports. What a miserable existence. I'll never do it. I'll end up doing it because I love my kid. It's unreasonable, but when you fall in love, stuff becomes reasonable that used to be unreasonable. And it wasn't reasonable for the host. It wasn't reasonable to the disciples, but it was reasonable to her because she loved much. Notice then thirdly, not only does she stop asking, what do I need to do to get by? And she starts asking, what could I do to please him? Not only does she start finding things that used to be unreasonable, reasonable, but there is a joy in the doing of it all. There's a joy in the doing. You don't get it as much here. You get it more in John chapter 12. But I don't think those are tears of sorrow. I think those are tears of joy. And when you look at the scene, she's the happiest one in the room. She has just given the ultimate financial sacrifice, a year's wages. She's, in many ways, in their opinion, humiliated herself by kneeling and drying his feet with her hair. And yet, I think she's the happiest one in the room. She's the one crying. And I don't think those are tears of sorrow. Those are tears of joy. And somewhere in your life, when you fall in love with a person, you know what happens? You start trying to please them, and it becomes a joy in the doing. It's not a sorrow. When you have to bring home those roses, and they just cost you $50, Valentine's Day is a ripoff, because I could have got them for $10 last week, but I paid the premium today to bring them home. You don't do it in that attitude, do you? It's a joy. It's a joy. Loving your kids, serving your children, it becomes a joy when you love them. In fact, many people will tell me, we have a 4-year-old and a 5-year-old. And it's not uncommon for people who have are in the farther stages of life to say to us, you know what? Enjoy your kids. Those were the best years of our life. Enjoy your children. Those are the best years of your life. Strangely enough, they're the most giving years of your life. You don't get anything from your kids. They don't give you resources. They're takers. They're takers. I mean, your 4-year-old isn't coming up and saying, I'm so proud of you, Dad. They're not. That's not what they're functioning. They may not even be saying that when they're 18. You're not getting from your children. You're giving and you're giving and you're giving. And again, when you get to the end of your life, you look at the time of giving, and you may very well say, that was the best years of my life. Those were the happiest. There was so much joy. You weren't receiving, though. But you were giving, and there was a joy in the doing. Jesus says, that's what love looks like. That's what love looks like. You stop asking, how cheap can I get out on? And you start saying, what would please the person I love? The things you used to find as unreasonable, you find as perfectly reasonable. And there is a joy in the doing. Now, I've got to tell you that this passage has been a troublesome passage for me in my Christian life. Because Jesus goes on to say in verse 40 through 47... I'm just going to talk about this quickly. I'm not starting a new sermon, by the way, so rest easy. Because there's food. I understand, I understand, and I like chicken like the rest of you. You know. Well, it's an old joke. You know you're called to preach when you start liking chicken, and so on. But this passage used to trouble me. Because Jesus goes on to say that the people who love the most are forgiven of the most. You notice that in the last verse there, to verse 47. And that always seemed to be a type of predestination to me. Because I became a Christian when I was 17. And there was a way in which I did not stray as others strayed. My father was a pastor. And it was a bit of a protected environment. And I remember the old timers used to stand up and they would talk about how they went into deep sin. And deep sin is basically sin that could land you in jail or embarrass your mother. And so they would go into deep sin. And I would sit and listen to their deep sins. And at least in my heart, I said, I've never sinned that way. I mean, and what Jesus seems to be saying is, if you do a lot of sinning and you get forgiven of it, you'll love much, but those of you who grew up in sheltered homes where you really didn't break out, you became Christians when you were much younger at youth camps, and you never did really stray into the culture, into the world, well, you're out of luck because you didn't do a lot of sinning, and so you're just sort of predestined not to love like other people love. And I read that passage at times, even after I became a Christian, and it just seemed like, what's the hope for me? I mean, I don't feel like I love Jesus enough, but I mean, how do I love Jesus? Do I have to go out and rob a bank or, you know, start fights or vote libertarian to, you know, do something really bad to, you know, and then I could repent of it and then I could love Jesus again. And that's how you increase your love for Jesus. And it troubled me. But then something came to me, and I think it came from God, that I'd never thought about. It's so simple, and it's embarrassing to think I'd never thought about it up to that point, but I just never thought about it before. And what came to me was this, and it changed how I thought about that passage. This is what came, that Jesus wants a relationship with me. He calls me to be his bride. Ephesians chapter 5, we're all, as the church, his bride. He wants a close relationship with me. And in close relationships, what is serious and non-serious gets flipped upside down. In other words, the serious issues in a relationship aren't serious legal issues. They aren't. There are things that are, that the worst things you do in a marriage aren't the worst things you do outside of the marriage. The relationship changes what's serious and what's not. For instance, suppose that you're a woman and that you're married to the perfect man. I don't know what perfection looks like to you. It might be George Clooney or Tom Selleck or Stephen Aiken. I don't know. But at least for one woman in the room. But I don't know what perfection looks like to you. I don't know what perfection acts like to you. But this man is perfect in appearance, in resources, in the way that he treats you. He has no flaws. You cannot find a single flaw in this man. He is the perfect husband, and everybody tells you so. He only has one flaw, and it's a very small flaw. He looks right. He talks right. I mean, he always says the right thing. He's always doing extra things for you. He's just got one little flaw, and that is that very frequently he's embarrassed to be seen in public with you. That's it, right? That's not even worth mentioning, right? Because he's perfect in every other way, and being embarrassed to be seen with you in public, that's a minor thing. You wouldn't even bring that up, would you? If you were married to him? Or suppose you're a man, and you're married to the perfect woman. again. She looks like what you want her to look like. She has all the delicacies. She's, you know, Martha Stewart on steroids. Everything looks right. She's just a perfect woman. I mean, everybody says, how did you marry her? She doesn't have a flaw. She's perfect. Well, except for one little thing. It's a small thing, really. She tends to be very cold, and she doesn't like you touching her. That's it. That's not worth mentioning, right? That's not going to cause a problem in that marriage, is it? Because she's perfect in every other way. She's just a little bit cold, and she doesn't like you being around her that much. That's not a problem, is it? You can't go to jail for that. Or again, imagine that you are a woman. Again, he's perfect in every way. No flaws. Your mother says, how in the world did you get that guy to marry you? Perfect. The only problem with him, and this isn't a problem for him, but it might be a problem for you. One day he confesses to you that he's everything's perfect, does everything, all the little extras, nothing left undone. He just, you know, confesses to you one day that he thinks he probably married you for your money, but that's a small thing, right? I mean, he just mainly wants to be married to you for your money, and that's not grounds for divorce, is it? Because he's perfect, right? Imagine, again, you're a man and perfect wife. Not a single flaw, except for one. She doesn't know how to say thank you. Whatever you do for her, however much you give, she is perfect, she's flawless. But no matter how much you do for her, she doesn't know how to say thank you. Would you bring that up if you were the husband? Or would you just, because she's perfect in every other way, that's not a big deal, is it, in a marriage? See, what began to dawn on me was this. That as I looked at my life, and sure I had been sheltered, sure I had not gone into deep sin, but there were days and there were months. Jesus could do 100 things for me and I could thank him for one or two. I was too busy to say thank you at times. Have you ever had that in your life? And you're just so busy, you can only pray a couple minutes. Jesus gave you life. He gave you being. He's provided all of your needs. And he's done such wonderful things. We live and move and have our being in him. You know, of all the wonderful things, you just don't have time to say thank you. That's not a small thing. That's not a small thing. Being married to a person who doesn't know how to say thank you is not a small thing. The fact that you are an ungrateful servant of Christ is a really big issue. It's a big issue. I begin to think about all the times I sit on church pews and I was cold towards God. God wanted to do something in my life, and all I could think about was the people who wronged me or the decisions I had coming up. There's God. We're on a date. There's worship, and my heart should have been drawing near to him. But I was so cold. Have you gone through periods in your life, even in your Christian life, when you're cold towards God? It's worship's about seeing the show. Even in your prayer life, it's very repetitive. There isn't any warmth. God, I mean, listen, God wants to draw near to you. He wants to be closer than a brother to you. He wants this intimacy with you. And it's so easy for you to deprive him of that intimacy. Because you're busy, you have stuff to do, you're mad, you're stressed, whatever. Listen, that's not a small thing in a marriage. It's not a small thing with God. Month after month, week after week, the coldness and the deadness that you've allowed to accumulate, that's not a small sin. It's not a small sin. The days when I have sit in classrooms and people have criticized Jesus Christ, people have taken religion, you know, to the whipping post. And I didn't say anything because I don't want people to know that I was a Christian. I mean, it's, you know, just let it slide. Nothing can be done, you'd say to yourself. But all those times when I was embarrassed to tell people that my life is committed to Jesus Christ, He is my Lord and Savior, and I'm depending on Him to get me to heaven. All the times I was embarrassed to say that. That's not a small thing. It's not a small thing when you're embarrassed to tell people that that woman there is the woman I love. It's not a small thing in a marriage. It's not a small thing in your walk with God. It's a big thing. It's a big issue. And then I thought about the times when, God forgive me, when I was more into God for what I could get out of Him than I was to give myself to Him. I needed healing. I needed blessing. I needed a job. I needed from God. And my prayer life was all about give me, give me, give me. Instead of, Lord Jesus, what can you do in my life? How can I serve you? How can I be a blessing for you? Do you listen to your prayers? Do you listen to your prayers? Do you get in that rut where it's 90% of give me, give me, give me? Listen, you're in God for what you can get out of Him. And that's not a small thing. It's not a small thing for a man to be married to a woman for what he can get out of her. It's not a small thing for you to serve God for what you can get out of Him. As I begin to weigh those times in my life, I never came home drunk. Never came home high. And I always came home. I didn't go out into that world, that underculture, the underbelly of our culture. My coldness towards God, my ingratitude, my unthankfulness, the times when I ducked when I should have stood for Him and claimed Him, the times when I used Him, He drove home to me. And I saw the enormity of it all. The absolute enormity of it all. If I'd have done all that to my wife, she would have divorced me. But God didn't divorce me. He has forgiven me. He has saved me. He has forgiven me of ingratitude and coldness and using and my cowardly ways. So I repented of it. And because of that, I know I have been forgiven much. The way you love much is that you remember you are not a small sinner. You were not a small sinner. Let me say it that way. You were not a small sinner. Maybe you went into deep sin. May the Lord remind you of the hole He drug you out of. But maybe you sit on a church pew and you weren't much of a mate for God. Those are big sins too, and may He remind you of those today. Will you stand with me? Helen Hayes was an old actress, more stage than movies. She was asked once in an interview, what is charm? She thought about it. She said, charm is that thing that if you have it, you don't need much else. And if you don't have it, not much else will do. Page after page of the Bible says that about love. If you love Him, you don't need much else. But if you don't love Him, not much else you have will do. The call for Christians everywhere is to remember that He is calling you and He's asking for your heart. The greatest command is to love Him with all of your heart, soul, and mind. That's the greatest command. If you miss it, you missed it. Even when Peter fell, Jesus said, Peter, let's move beyond all this other stuff. Peter, do you love me? Do you love me? People who love, stop asking the question, how little do I have to do? What does He want me to do? People who love find things that used to be unreasonable, perfectly reasonable, and they do them, and there's a joy in the doing. Maybe it's time for you to return to your first love. You come and you pray, and Jesus will accept you. He helps us when we're down. He opens his arms to us. Listen, anybody who ever came to God finds him to be far more gracious than they ever thought he would be. But you have to bring it to him. Then maybe today there's a decision in your future. You have a decision coming up this week, and you need to pray about that. The Lord grants wisdom to those who ask. Did you know that's in the Bible? You ask, he'll give it. You have decisions coming, and you want to bring those to the Lord today. You bring those. And maybe there's somebody you want to pray for today, and they're in need, and they're struggling, and you want to bring them to the Lord today. You bring your needs, the needs nobody knows about, the needs everybody knows about. You bring them to the Lord today as we sing.